Welcome to the 10K Collective podcast. Listen, if you want hacks, my friend, I'm afraid you're in the wrong place. Our philosophy has grown out of the 10K Collective London Masterminds. Members, by the way, make between $500,000 and $7 million a year in e-commerce, most on Amazon. Many have doubled revenue in the last 12 to 18 months. If you're that kind of person, this podcast is made for you. We're not puritanical. We use hacks. We just don't think you should focus on them if you're building a real business. Instead, we focus on what's been proven to work in the group. Real brand building, clear strategic objectives, courageous long-term goals, and long-range thinking. If you like that focus, keep listening, and welcome to the 10K Collective. Ladies and gentlemen, we are here with Jana Krychik of YLT Translation. So they focus very much on Amazon listings, but of course there's a ton of other texts that we need in our lives as Amazon sellers, which they also deal with, which are not listings. So we're going to talk about that now. First of all, let's talk about what's your sort of starting point for even considering or working on this other stuff? Do we need to start from scratch again, like we do with the listing, or do we just translate what we have? What's the basic approach here?
Well, basically, all the other translations that sellers need, as for instance, image translations, packaging translations, follow-up emails, Q&As, you don't need to insert any of the keywords there. When it comes to image translations, a lot of people ask, are these keywords going to be ranked or not? Well, I have never got any confirmation about this, but sometimes people use keywords, sometimes people don't get keywords, and they do get indexed, they don't get indexed. So it's a really 50-50 chances. It's all about A/B testing. So I would encourage people to do maybe a couple of versions with keywords and then just, you know, do the split testing as well. One thing I know in EBC, when you have images over there, is that in the name of this picture you upload, you can write a long tail keyword and that is supposed to get indexed. This is also what I've heard from one of the customer representatives in Amazon. So I would also suggest A/B testing, but definitely I think that it might work because the algorithm scans through all of the listing, and then this gets scanned because it's a file name. You know, it's not a picture, it's actually a file name. So I would say that would be a good idea. When it comes to follow-up emails, you don't need any keywords at all. Customer Q&As, basically reviews are very important for the idea of keywords as well, because I don't know how many people know, but you can also get keywords from your reviews. So basically, and you can also find out what other usage your product can have, something you have never thought of. Like, for instance, we have like this painting marker, and then it was for kids, but the review said that the customer could, you know, fix his chair color on the leg of the chair with that, and it was like such a good product because it was like a really high quality color. So if a lot of people mentioned that, you might want to put it in your listing. So when you give an answer to the review, you might also want to use keywords because the keywords also get scanned. And then also because of the keyword from the review, your product can also show up. So for the products, for the product Q&As and review answers, you should use some keywords as much as makes sense. Also, when it comes to packaging translations, you don't have to use any keywords because it's just a text on your packaging that doesn't get scanned by any algorithm other than the barcode scanner. And that's basically it.
Right. So there are some places that you still need to think about keywords. So in the image names, that makes sense. And again, you might as well try it just in case, because the worst case scenario is you optimize the image file names and it doesn't do anything. It's not going to take you very long, but also A/B testing for everything. If in doubt, test. Absolutely agree with that. The other thing, though, that you've just put a nice little hack answering reviews, you can use keywords and that helps your Amazon rank listing rank, right? That gets reviewed. Is that right? The answers to
Yes, exactly. Right. Exactly. There's also a little really nice tool also from Helium 10. It's called the Review Downloader. And then, for instance, you can also research your customers or, sorry, competitors' reviews like that. So you can go to the competitors page, and if he has like 50 reviews, you can download all of them. This little tool will extract all of the keywords he found in the reviews. So you can also get keyword ideas that way.
Well, Helium 10 seems to be willing out as your favorite tool here, which makes sense, but it's pretty
definitely,
good. Yeah.
Definitely,
yeah,
yes.
It's pretty good. And we can also get people a small deal on that if they want to check the show notes. By the way, the show notes for this, as every other episode, if you go to 10 kcollective.com. I'm not even sure which episode number this is, somewhere in the 40s now, because we're producing so many, but it might be worth it as ever to review the details. So let's talk about packaging then. So obviously you don't need to worry about keywords. So I guess you're free to think more about the other issues we've mentioned in the previous episode, which is the style and storytelling and other things, right? So what's your approach to packaging translation?
Well, the packaging translation is basically you have to listen to your client. So you have to be on the same page. So the clients have very strict instructions about the packaging. Like, would they like to have like this jolly message on them, or really strict, or just like some basic information? We don't use any graphic designer skills. So we just deliver the text, and then they do make the fonts and other things. But you really have to listen to the customer, what they want to, what kind of message they want to deliver. As I said, it's very important what type of the product they're selling. You know, it's not going to be the same. They're selling a teddy bear or some baby shower basket, or if they're selling screwdrivers and garden tools. So it's really important. And some of the customers won't have like this wordplay. Some of them were very, very strict. You really have to keep it short. So it's very, it's always challenging to do the packaging translation, because you have to keep it short, but to deliver the message to the clients. And again, localization is the mother of it all, because you really have to adjust everything so it sounds appealing to the target audience.
Okay, localization is the mother of it all. I like it. I think that's the key to everything we're saying in these episodes with you. It seems really like in the end, you've got to have a native speaker or somebody who's really as close to native speaker as possible to get whether it's sort of going to feel right to that culture or not. And that's quite a subtle thing, right? It's very hard to train a machine to do that, because it is a human nuanced decision. So I think that's...
Exactly. And you said also a really interesting thing in the previous episode about how putting in and setting in keywords in the listing and making it all sound very native is really complicated. And at first, and I could totally agree with that, because at first I worked with people who were very rarely like native speakers, but you know, they were born in another country, and then at the age of 5, they moved elsewhere. So they basically spoke the language for about 20 years or something, but they were not a good fit for the listing. So even them were not good fit for listings, because there are some like small like things that natives would, they would just pay attention to when they insert these keywords, and they would just say, no, this doesn't sound good to me. It sounds a bit weird. So you really want to have a native speaker, because they're the only ones who can incorporate these keywords. Sometimes it's very, very hard to incorporate it in a very highly specific technical text. So you really want to have somebody who is absolutely native in the language and who studied language, I don't know, was working as a journalist, an SEO within the industry. You really want to have top-notch people for that, because you don't want I don't want a client coming back to me and saying, wow, this sounds really weird. And then I say, yeah, but it's, you know, it's a weird keyword. And if it's a weird keyword, then you don't use it. You know, it's, you know, you just have to save something, then you put it in backends, you know, like really good keywords, which you cannot use because they sound weird. You can always put in backends. The most important thing is never to repeat them throughout the listing or backends, like never to repeat the keywords, because you want to maximize the number of the indexed characters, definitely.
Okay, so we're getting back onto listings here. So just let's deal with this, because it's a question that comes up. Mm-hmm. Repeating keywords or not repeating keywords. I've had very different things from some pretty serious sellers. What's your view on that? You shouldn't bother repeating keywords then.
Well, I see a lot of people repeating long tail keywords. And what happened to me recently for the German market is that a lot of people don't actually understand. And these were like really big sellers, because we were working with a lot of high figure sellers. So he told me there was a German listing saying, what was it? I can't remember, but it was a long tail keyword. And the first keyword was repeating, because it is a long tail keyword. And you cannot just, separate long tail keywords. It's actually one, but it consists of two words. So we had like one word, which was the same. And then the second word, which was changing, like travel mug, plastic mug, reg mug, you know, but you have to keep it like that, because it's all results of one keyword. And he told me, like, why were you repeating the keywords? Like, this is not okay. Like, you repeated it like 30 times. And we always mark keywords in red. So it's very, very transparent. Where is the keyword and what consists of two or three words? And I just told him, like, no, we're not repeating keywords. This is one keyword. And we have different variations of different long tail keywords. And that is something completely different than repeating the same keywords which you definitely shouldn't do, because you want to be indexed for as many keywords possible. Of course, I'm not talking about overstuffing the listings or anything, but basically you should not repeat the keywords you already use. So if you use a travel mug in title, you never repeat it again, not even in backends. If you use the red mug in the first title, you don't repeat it anywhere else. But it's okay to use long tail keywords because they're all considered as one keyword. Basically, you can get indexed for about 20 to 30 keywords per listing, depending on the length of your listing.
Okay, so 20 to 30 keywords, that's a worthwhile figure to have there. And that sort of ties in with what I tell people and as clients and most of my friends who sell on Amazon say. So just to clarify about this thing then. So if I had, for example, travel mug, I don't want to repeat that ever. That makes sense. But what about if I have red travel mug, blue travel mug made of plastic, travel mug with handle? Is that, those are, you know, I suppose we have to clarify what we mean by keyword. Is a phrase, really, isn't it? I mean, it's never just one word, but
yeah, it's a syntagm. So if something like that shows up and it's like that in the search result, that is one long tail keyword, and that counts as one keyword. So according from my experience, it's always going to be like long tail keywords used once per listing. Of course, some of the parts of the keyword have to repeat, but it's a different keyword. It wouldn't make any sense if you just used one part of the keyword and just kind of put it in the text, because this is what people type in the search field. And I don't think that people would get such good results if they just used adjectives, which come with the main word within this syntax.
Okay, so for example, you couldn't just put travel mug once and then put the word red somewhere else and expect to rank for red travel mug.
Exactly. Right? You're not going to rank for that.
Yeah, which is interesting, because I think some of the guidance from Amazon, and this changes every sort of few months, but the average of the guidance from Amazon seems to be that they want you to do that and that their algorithm will piece together the keywords magically. But a lot of the serious sellers I know, I mean, people doing, you know, $1 million months in Q4 will say, no, that's not how it seems to work. Actually, exact match is important.
Exactly.
In your listing, and that's your view as well.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Absolutely. And I always explain to our clients, how are we going to do it, and you know, did we use long tail keywords, and this is how we do it. And if there's some like different how they want us to do that, you know, we can do it, but this works best from our experience. I don't think that the algorithm would all the time necessarily combine the things together, you know, connect the dots. It might happen sometimes, but I think in a lot of more cases that it would not happen, definitely. So, you know, like what you can do is, like, for instance, in search terms and backends, what we do also is not to repeat any of the keywords. So we would, in the backends, we would not put like travel green mug, for instance, if we don't have it in, we would just put green. So we would put just basically the adjectives and something which describes the product or a related product, let's say glass or a bottle, or let's say running, or something which is related topic to the product, we would put that in backend. So your product can sometimes show up for related product. And then your product, if they buy it, then the product can show up in the frequently bought together, and you get a really good commercial with that advertisement for your product. So I think that I would stick to that when it comes to backends, but when it comes to listing, I wouldn't. Do that. We had really good results using the long tail keywords. As I said, some people can get lucky even with Google Translate listings and just sell the product because it happened to be a keyword in the French market, just written like that. But it's basically a matter of luck. And if you have a really, really, really good product, you're probably going to sell it even though you have a Google Translate listing, you know.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, just because you could do something okay despite a massive flaw in your process doesn't mean it's not worth fixing the flaw, because you might double your revenue and you really might improve it. So let's talk about follow-up emails, because we talked about indexing and listings a lot. We talked about packaging, so it's obviously quite a challenge to get the brand across in a very short space. What about the follow-up emails in different marketplaces? Have you got any sort of general tips or very specific ones for particular marketplaces?
Yes. So the German market, people usually experiment with, as I said, the form of an email and informal, where they are talking to you, like to the second person singular, other than second person plural. So that's very important. And people like us to do the both versions. So they do like split testing and see what works best. But when it comes to Spanish and Italian and French market, it's usually the second person singular that works fine. And then, as I said, depending on the product, a lot of people want to be like playful language, and like if you're selling a baby hamper basket or a teddy bear set, you want to be like you want to have some rhymes in your email. It really has to be a good fit with your brand and your storytelling from your listing. That's really important. And a lot of people end an email by the first name of the owner of the brand, so they make it really, very personal. So they mean that, you know, people appreciate you buying this. Of course, a lot of people still ask for reviews, even though this is against TOS. But a lot of people want to make it a really like a personal email with a personal touch saying thank you from the brand owner.
It's a personal touch, so that's the same as in the US. And I think you're saying in Germany, you've got a split test. I guess it depends whether you're selling sort of fluffy bunnies or cough medicine or something, right? So, but it's interesting. You're saying in French, Spanish, Italian markets, the more casual version works fine.
Yes, right? Usually that's what type of emails we get. And then they ask us, you know, how should we do it? And, you know, my translator will tell me like, look, I don't think we should do this because nobody in French would like say something like this. Like nobody would offer for instance, also in Germany, also people don't want that, you know, you have like this pushy, like buy our product is the best in the universe thing. They just want the German audience decides if they're going to buy the product or not. They don't want to be pushed into buying something they really don't like. So, you know, that bit of a salesy language is a no-go also for the German market.
Yeah. And the other thing is that even between America and Britain, shocking as it may be to some Americans, there is quite a big culture difference, which I think is sometimes not acknowledged. I mean, it's very Americanized. I mean, look, I spend my life speaking to Americans in the podcast, of course, so I'm particularly in that sort of Americanized world. But when it comes to sales language, I mean, some of the emails that I've had, sort of follow-up emails from American-based sellers, and it's just a bit mental. It's like, awesome, you're the best person in the world. I always think, you've never met me. You don't know that. And by the way, that's great if you're selling to Californians. I guess even within America, there's huge variety of responses to that kind of email. But I would encourage you to, even if you're British American and selling to Brits, to kind of change the language a little bit.
Yeah, because like not to be that pushy and be like, dude, I'm not comfortable with this. You know, this is like this, you're fabulous. You are the star. You're a superstar, blah, blah, blah. You know, like, I don't think that people like that. And I know, like, because I've been speaking at a lot of these conferences. And then, you know, like, when an American speaker pops up, you know, people in Europe are like, you know, because a lot of Americans, they just use like their, you know, overly salesy, like fabulous, like cursing and stuff like that. And people in Europe are like, well, you know, he's just, you know, American, you know, like, it's like, what's your thoughts on this? It's like, oh, he or she, they're just American, you know, and people just can understand that that's like their, how their culture is. And that's it. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they like it or not, but people in Europe, they have completely different style of presentation, speaking, writing listings and everything.
By the way, I just want to point out that it goes the other way as well. If you are British and a bit reserved,
absolutely,
or German, when you're writing in America, you have to write in a way that probably makes you feel like you're shouting a little bit, because that is the nature of the marketplace. And I'm not saying that quality sales language or sophistication isn't necessary. Of course, it's a very sophisticated nation of consumers, America, of course. But the style is different. They're used to people saying, this is the best. This is awesome. You're amazing. You rock.
Yeah.
You're a
and
rock
it's
star.
Really, and it's really hard.
If you don't say that, you're going to come across as rather depressive.
so you really
have to adjust to that in both directions. I think that's really important.
It's really challenging, I think, for Europeans to get to that American style, so it sounds natural. Because you can have a lot of like really big misses, like with just like saying something in an email, and like American people will be like, "Okay, he's just like trying too hard." You know, it's just like sounds weird because you're not too familiar with that. So I would say that the American style is as challenging as the European style for Americans, definitely.
100%. And again, the thing, people get very confused between language and language. I mean, language, okay, English and American, we've already talked British English and American English, kind of similar. And yes, you can look up in a dictionary, or we know that words like faucet or pants or whatever are different. Heard, you know, it's quite a lot of common words. But cultural differences are harder to get. For example, a lot of English people think they can do an American accent, but most of us do a horrible job. And there's no such thing as just an American accent. It depends, are you from the South, are you from Texas, are you from Bronx, are you from Brooklyn, even different parts of New York. So in the end, what we think we know and don't know is often what kills us, right? If you don't speak German, you know that. But I would really encourage you, if you're serious about selling a product, you're British and selling a product in America, to approach an American copywriter to do some of your listings for you, or certainly follow-up emails, because you are trying for a completely different market, in my opinion. So there you go. Even within the same language, it's not the same language. See what I mean? And I think that's really quite a strong difference. So let's talk about some of the other stuff outside of follow-up emails. Ads. Do you deal with Facebook ads or things like that? Because that's obviously a huge area potentially for translations.
Yes, we used to do Facebook ads, but we didn't get as many requests for that. So I think that the last one we did was maybe a year ago. It was also, you have like the certain rules, the certain legs you have to follow. And you would also like to have some really short phrases, something which is call to action. It's also very challenging whenever you have a really, really short form to actually express what the client wants. You know, as we mentioned, the German and French language, you know, sometimes you have to completely change what the customer wanted to say, because it's absolutely not going to fit in that. So that's a really, really short form. But we basically stopped doing that last year. But we had some things done, but we didn't get a lot of inquiries for foreign languages for Facebook ads. I think that people still stick to English versions for Facebook ads and other type of ads.
That's interesting. Well, there's obviously an opportunity there for somebody if they can be bothered to do ads in German and Facebook or what have you. I think it's going to be a tricky thing to do. What about Google? Is that something you've ever sort of translate ads for people now?
No. We didn't do anything with Google. We basically, before we started doing Amazon only, we were specialized in e-commerce translations, which is also quite interesting. We still do the website translations. That's also a different type of translations than Amazon listings or just plain regular translations. You get, for instance, when somebody sends you to translate how to turn on your washing machine, for instance, that's completely different than website translations. So with website translations, you also have to pay attention to keywords. You just use different tools. You can use a keyword planner. You can use SEMrush. Like there are like a lot of different tools you can use with that. And for that, you need the knowledge of the SEO. So you need to know how to also incorporate the keywords, how to, for all of them to sound very native. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. So it's also very important, but unlike the Amazon listings, they're not going to be any like length limits. Of course, you don't want your blog to have like 3,000 words, but definitely when it comes to e-commerce, which are selling products, you would definitely want to have a title of your product with some keywords and a description of the product with some also a couple of relevant keywords. You don't have to have that many, but it's really important to have really the high traffic ones. And it's much easier to find good keywords when you're doing the SEO other than Amazon, because on Amazon, you can really get like this super, super specific products. And from all of the e-commerce websites we worked on, a lot of them were basically things that you can sell really easy and are popular products. And nobody, I don't think that we had anybody who was selling something which was like a niche instead of a niche, you know, like a very specific one. So that's really important, the keywords as well when doing the website translation.
Okay, so is website translation something you do a lot of? And is it basically for people who mostly sell on Amazon, or is that something you've got a sort of quite a big portfolio of?
Well, it's quite different because a lot of people who sell on Amazon, they also have their websites because they also want to have other sales channels. But we also have a lot of sellers who just sell online, like they have their own like website, not even like Shopify and stuff, just like regular websites. And we also do a lot of proofreading of these websites and correction. And we do a lot of that for Scandinavian languages. We just recently was speaker at this event in Copenhagen for the Danish industry e-commerce. And we got a lot of people who were interested in actually checking the website. And I was really surprised how many people just used the Google Translate or a lot of, you know, college students, they paid them like 3 cents a word and they were just kind of, you know, selling the product. I mean, that did not stop them from selling their products because a lot of them were fairly good products. But as you said, you know, imagine how much better they would have been doing if they had like keywords, if they had a better Google page rank, and if they were maybe, you know, doing the Google ads, you know, all of that. It's like, you know, small pieces of puzzle that you have to put together in order to get like a really, really good product in form of your website.
Yeah, I think one of the classic errors is that people get a good enough result, but they don't examine scientifically, if you like, how they're getting it. So they don't know whether it's good. If your product should be getting excellent sales and it's merely getting good sales, that's actually not a good result. So there's something wrong with your process. And I think if you've got a very strong product or strong brand, that can compensate for a lot of things, which is great. But that doesn't mean that you won't massively increase things. And especially if you're paying for traffic in any form, whether it's SEO or ads, to not optimize for conversions seems to me absolutely crazy, because quite often the break even or loss or profit difference to the entire system comes down to quite small differences in percentage of the conversion rate. Right? If you're breaking even at 2%, you're losing a lot of money at 1.5% and you're making a lot of money at 3%, right? So why you wouldn't optimize for that is, yeah, I guess we just get overwhelmed. But I just encourage anyone who's got any listing, whether it's on Amazon or on their Shopify or whatever, in whatever market, to really go and look at the numbers, because you can't be amazed at how much more money you could make without spending a lot more.
Exactly. Just like do a split testing. You don't have to translate your whole website. You can just do a split testing on one of your pages, you know, like one of your page, you can just redo it and see how well it's going to perform. I mean, I always take my own website as an example, because I know how much traffic we got after we optimized our website about a year and a half ago. So now we basically, when you type in like Amazon listing translations or listing translations, we rank second or first, depending on the market. Like for instance, for the US market, we ranked second, you know, which was amazing. And then just a year and a half ago, we were like basically on page four or like nowhere to be found. So I really would put a lot of effort in SEO, and as well as if when talking about Google, of course, Google Ads. But I think that a lot of people, for instance, find us on Google. They don't even look for ads or anything. They just kind of type in. They're like, well, I might want to try this service as well. And what I also would recommend people on website is, for instance, we have chat, and people love to have real-time chat, not the auto chat bot, but people want to have like a real person, and they're super happy when they have a real person on chat, answer their emails, and they feel like you're devoting time to them. And basically, almost every person that went on our chat sent us an email, and we closed the deal with the person. So I would say that having a chat or something which implies that an actual human is going to answer your problems, or that the client is going to feel valued, I think that's going to also add to the whole value that your website has.
That's very interesting. So you found that people translate from chat to email to, yes, to becoming clients. That's
absolutely,
that's a really powerful bit of personal experience. I mean, obviously you're in the business of selling services, business to business, rather than physical products, business to consumer.
It's more B2B.
But nevertheless, it implies it's very powerful. And what's interesting, and there are all those different approaches, we've had people on the podcast talking about chatbots and automated flows, but it's always interesting to come back to the human to human interaction, because in the end it's hard to overcome that sense of nuances and what's the right next thing to say from a well-tamed person, right?
Exactly. But like right now you can really get cheap people. Like you can have like, I think a dollar per minute. Like we use Talk, TAWK.TO, and they offer like a dollar per minute assistance. So when somebody from my team is not online, I can always hire somebody there. And even though they don't have like all the answers or something asked very specifically, they can say like, you can send us an email and like our team is going to get back to you. But you actually talk to a real person, and then you can feel the difference between having to talk to a robot and to a real person. So I would say that's a really, really good thing. And another thing which I started doing about half a year ago is that on the forum where it says contact us, I just left a link to my Calendly, and I say, like, if you don't want to fill out this form, just schedule a free call with me. And a lot of people schedule a free call because a lot of people love to talk. They love to talk and hear something about your services. They want to hear your voice. They want to picture who you are. Are you a serious person? Where you're from? You know, they love to hear this. And after that, I always close the deal, like every short, like 15-minute meeting. And I always think it's worthy to have extra time to hop on a call with potential new clients. I think that the human contact is something that everybody's striving for in this era of chatbots and like robots and stuff. Of course, to a certain extent, like I don't want to spend my 24 hours talking to people, but I think that a lot of people appreciate that a lot. A lot of big clients are sick of big corporations being treated like they're, you know, not important, answering emails after 15 days and stuff like that. So what I'm trying to do and what I would recommend other maybe service providers, it's kind of to make it more personal experience when people contact them, especially if they are a small business like we are.
Excellent. That's really, really good. I like that. And it's quite an efficient combination. In fact, if you think about it, there's quite a degree of automation because people come to your site because of SEO, which is an ongoing automatic process you're not involved in. They're using Calendly to book you in and it's 15 minutes of your time. So in the end, you've done some finding the right kind of people already by your website, right? And the fact that they click on the Calendly, most people won't. So there's quite a filter there. So you're ending up spending your time talking to people who know their stuff. As you say, this is a model that's probably more applicable to the service type things. I know a lot of the serious Amazon sellers that I work with are starting to unsurprisingly turn to the agency model because it's better for cash flow, although it's very intensive and not as scalable as a product-based business. As I'm sure working with translators, that's ultra intensive work. But, you know, why not have the two? In the end, the distinction between services and products can be a very artificial one. I'd encourage people to just do what makes sense for them. So that's hopefully useful for those guys as well. But I mean, I love that. I don't want to add much more to this because I think that's a wonderful note to end on, that people need human contact and the power of that and the power you found as a business of that. Just a couple of things to wrap up on them. First of all, if people want to work with you, have you got any contact details or any deals that you can offer our listeners as well?
Yes, definitely. If you guys want to contact us, and I would like to invite all the listeners of Michael's podcast to contact us by our email, which is info@ylt-translations.com. Or you can visit our website. As I previously mentioned, somebody's going to be live on our chat 24 hours. So our website is ylt-translations.com. And I would like to offer 20% on all of our services to all of the listeners out there. And you can activate this discount just by sending amazing 20 as a coupon code in the subject of an email. And that's it.
Excellent. So yeah, special deals here, folks. Amazing 20 in the subject of an email. You don't even need to say Mike sent us, you'll get a discount, which is definitely worth having. 20%, pretty substantial discount. The last thing then to ask you, apart from saying thank you for bringing some really excellent, you know, frontline translation reality to the table, if nothing else, if it encourages somebody to go off and do a proper translation in, say, Germany or Japanese, where there's so much business to be had and they double, you know, their business there, then send me an email and tell me because I'd be delighted. I know that there's so much money to be made. I've been sort of bullying people every so often myself, and they go and do a half job in Germany and they get a lot more money. So I would encourage you to get hold of Jana and her team and do a great job. What would you say the sort of final bit of advice from you, one, two, or three pieces of advice in the area of translations for e-commerce?
Well, as we previously mentioned, definitely native translators and definitely somebody who has had some experience. I would always ask for somebody's recommendations or work that somebody has done. If you don't want to hire a translation agency, if you want to just hire a translator, you want to have a proofreader for sure. And you don't want this proofreader to be your friends, neighbors, or anybody else that can just read a text. I would also like to hire a proofreader that knows why this keyword is placed here and why the keyword is placed there. So apart from the text type sounding native, you really have to have good keywords. And number three is please don't use Google Translate. It's not going to do you any good. You might get lucky and it is for free. But, you know, things that are for free usually cost us the most at the end.
Nice. Things that are free usually cost us most at the end. I think, yeah, you're right. In the end, there's no such thing as a free lunch. So thank you for that reminder of a bit of business reality. Jan, it's a great pleasure to have you on. And thank you very, very much for your help and guidance.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the 10K Collective podcast. I really hope you found the show helpful. I mentioned the London-based masterminds we've been running since September 2017. Members of the 10K Collective Mastermind make a minimum of about £480,000 a year, well over €600,000 or dollars. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/10KC, K for Kilo, C for Charlie. £1 million mastermind members make a minimum of £1.2 million a year. That's about $1.5 million US or euros. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/MPM. That's M for mother, P for Peter, M for mother. Thanks for listening.